start this tape for the fourth time before. So this is, so we're starting all over again as far as lessons. So lesson 1 and 2 of Hebrews 2. So it's just so you understand that. So as we see the perspective being that eternity is reality, that we live so transactionally, but God has something better for us, has always intended something better for us. Living transactionally is not life. And we think it is until it doesn't work, right? And then we're like, I don't know. I don't know how to do this. So we've talked a lot about transactional living. We'll bring it in again and understand the devastation of transactional living as far as God's concerned, and the life that transformational living that he offers is. So what I want to do is take a big picture of where we've been, showing us that it's the foundation for where we're going for the rest of Hebrews. So when we look at Hebrews' background, we remember that it was written to Jewish believers who are having hard times. And remember, they're hard times from the outside, but also from the inside. The church at the time, or the faithful community, is saying, oh, no, that isn't the way to live. You need to follow the rules. You need to follow the law. That's why things are so hard for you, is what they're saying. And that's where most of their persecution was coming from at this point. It wasn't coming mostly from the outside. It was coming mostly from the inside, which is where most of our criticism comes from, is from the inside. Oh, no, you're supposed to follow rules here. This is how you get life. You follow rules. And that's exactly opposite of what God has told us. So the Hebrews then, and us now, are tempted to go back to following the law rather than finding life in Jesus, who is grace. So that's the temptation that they have. And so the writer of Hebrews wants to encourage them. No, keep your focus on Jesus. He is where you're going to find life. He is where you're going to find grace. And that is life. So that's the whole emphasis of this writer here that Hebrews find. In fact, I love the fact that no one knows who wrote Hebrews. And I love, try going on the internet, try going on all the commentaries, and the discussions. They have longer discussions on who wrote Hebrews than all of the stuff in Hebrews. And you think, really? Cannot you just rest in the fact that God said, I don't want you to know who wrote Hebrews? Because the focus of Hebrews is to keep your eyes on Jesus. And literally, it's almost, at first it's funny, and then it just gets disheartening to think, are you kidding? You're spending all of your time on trying to figure out who wrote Hebrews. God didn't want you to know. I mean, what's the deal? So again, the focus is Jesus, the giver of life. So what we have started with is the writer begins by saying Jesus is God in chapter 1. And the fact that he is God instills awe in us. So he's first trying to instill awe. Jesus, this Jesus who you've been hearing about, who was within your contemporaries' lives, he was God. He was the one who created life by speaking it into being. And because he is the Word in the flesh, he is also the one who recreates life for you. He's restoring life. And this, for the writer, is trying to pull out this first awe. Be in awe of who this Jesus is. In chapter 2, he wants to instill comfort. And by comfort, I mean relief. This is a place that I can actually go. It's not, if he's God, then he's, distant from me. But in 2, he says, no, he's man. He understands you. Jesus, being man, completely understands what it is like to live in a world that is transactional. And he understands and sympathizes with the temptations that come with and the heartache that comes with living in a world that's transactional. He absolutely understands this. So it's the writer saying, yes, he's God and you should be in awe, but he's man and he so completely understands, you can come near to him and feel like, oh, I'm home, someone who completely understands what I'm going through. So it's this amazing thing that this writer does within two small chapters, instilling this awe and yet this relief, this comfort of, I can come near to this man because he knows what I'm going through. Chapter 3, then, the writer begins by instilling assurance that Jesus is the faithful Son, that he knows what he's doing. He is the builder, and he's building you up. He knows what he's doing, and he keeps on inviting you to be softened, or as we talked about last week, to be sanded down, your shininess of your rock being sanded down so that you fit together well. And he knows what he's doing. So you can be assured that even though that sanding does not look like a good thing, he knows what he's doing. So we have all of that as a foundation for the rest of Hebrews. Jesus is God. He's recreating you. Jesus is man. He understands you. Jesus is a faithful Son. He knows what he's doing. And because he's those things, when he takes on this role of high priestly, his high priest role, it makes that high priest role extraordinary. It makes it something that no other high priest has ever done, could do, and it makes Jesus more than just a savior. As we like to say, Jesus is our savior, but it means so little if we don't put in all of these things and then the fact of him being a high priest. Hebrews is going to key for the rest of the book on the fact that Jesus is a high priest, but it all rests on the foundation that he is God and man and faithful Son. So that's kind of where he's going, why he put all that, so that he can go into the place of high priesthood. And for the Hebrews particularly, they would have seen that word high priest and had all sorts of visions and ideas of what a high priest looked like and how essential a high priest was for them to live a life that was in communion with God. It was essential for them to have a high priest. So for them, it meant a lot. For us, we think, ooh, high priest, Old Testament, stuffy. But he's already laid the foundation. Well, Jesus isn't stuffy. Jesus has this personality of a human being. He has this personality that he's fun and that he's understanding of joy as well as sorrow, all of this. So he puts that on this high priest.
But that threw them off because he came from Judah, and that wasn't what they expected.
Mm-hmm.
Right,
right. And that's why the writer is going to explore his high priesthood in such depth. So we are going to really go into the depth of the high priesthood, even more so than we did in Leviticus. So what he's going to tell them, so he introduces in chapter 4 the fact that Jesus is the high priest. And what he's going to tell them in essence is he's the high priest so that he has opened the way to the throne of grace. So as a high priest, he's opened the way to the throne of grace. He continues to keep it open because he actually dwells in the real sanctuary. So it's not just that he's opened it like the high priest did once a year. He's opened it and kept it open because he's right there and he stays right there. He doesn't go in and out. But also that he is bringing us a sure hope of full healing, of full restoration of that life that we were meant for, that wholeness. That will heal us and we call save us. So that will be what he goes into as far as Jesus being the high priest and what that means for us. And this is where we get that hold fast, draw near, press on because of what the role of high priest does for Jesus and does for us. And what he will do as he's explaining this role of Jesus the high priest, he will intersperse it with, so what would you respond? How would you respond? Let's respond this way. Let's respond by holding fast to him. Let's respond by drawing near. Let's respond by pressing on to maturity. And he'll intersperse those with just showing the depth of his high priesthood. Basically, all of it in him showing that Jesus is high priest is to instill a true worship. To instill the understanding deep within us that Jesus is grace and that Jesus is life and that they are the same. That Jesus and grace and life, that's all the same. It's all eternity. And that would be to instill worship. We talk about worship a lot. I think we have a grasp of it, but perhaps not. I think the easiest way to say what worship is worship says this, whatever I'm worshiping, this is life. This means everything. I can do with anything without anything else except this. This is life. So we just had this question about what would you miss if it wouldn't be Thanksgiving dinner without this. Worship says it wouldn't be life without this. And so we think about that, and we have a lot of things that we say, oh, without a house, we wouldn't have life. And of course, right here we'll go, I wouldn't say that, but we do. And we do that by how we live. We show what we worship. We show what we say, this is life. This is essential. This is the essential. Without it, there isn't life. That's what worship is. So the writer of Hebrews is instilling in us what really is life. And so in his role of high priest, we're going to see that Jesus being grace is really what life is. So that's kind of where we're going with this, with the rest of Hebrews. Mm-hmm. That would be part of it. So as we go through this, let's see if we have the same question of what I mean by this is life. And that's where I'm warning you once again. As we talk about this, I think it's a hard concept to grasp because we live transactionally, because really what we're talking about is grace. And when we say that grace is life, that's really tough for us to wrap our head around. So hopefully as we go through this, we'll see Jesus' examples of giving life through grace and then understand that that's where we live and that that's what eternity is about. Because we tend to think of grace as a very, it starts off life for us and then we're on our own, or it's not for future, so therefore how could it be eternity? But grace itself is what eternity is, and that's what it's all about. Which I think is very hard for us to, and we'll talk about eternity in just a minute, how we tend to look at it. But let's first of all go back to Leviticus and be reminded of what the duties of a high priest were. I'll just sketch a big picture, because I think next week she's going to have you go a little bit more in depth. But I'll sketch a big picture of it so that we begin to understand what grace has to do with it all. So the first thing we know about a high priest is, who was the first high priest? Aaron. What was the very first thing that they did to Aaron to ordain him as a high priest? Yeah. And this was one of those lessons that you went, oh, that's big. So a high priest, the very first thing a high priest does is he is undressed in front of the congregation. So they actually brought Aaron in front of the congregation and Moses undressed him. So he had nothing on. As far as we know, he might have had something covering underneath. We don't know. But we know that he was undressed. And the fact that it was Aaron undressed in front of the congregation says a lot. Because what does the whole congregation in Leviticus, what does that whole congregation already know about Aaron? Yep. He was the one who led them into worship of the golden calf. And here he is, God's chosen one to be their high priest. And he's perfectly naked out there and saying, yep, this is me. I'm completely exposed. I'm completely vulnerable. It's me. And only by God's choosing am I your high priest. And only by God's choosing did all of that ugliness and darkness get transformed.
It feels like shame.
It feels like shame. But interesting, because God transforms it, right? Because after Moses undresses him, what does he then do?
But it's like it's like Israel being at Aaron's bad moment.
Right,
and
exactly.
Like, oh, I'm so comforted.
Yes, yes, that's the whole,
so
yes. Right. Right, exactly. That's exactly the point.
So much better about myself.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Yep, that's exactly it. It is this, oh, And for Aaron, think about it. Aaron now never has to hide that he, like, now that Moses dresses him in those beautiful priestly robes, Aaron doesn't have to pretend that he deserved those robes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to pretend that, well, he's been good all along. He's helped Moses lead them out all along. He doesn't have to pretend because he's been out there. Yep, you see me. You know what I did? And you see me exactly what I look like. This is who I am at.
So he doesn't have to pretend to be shining.
Right.
He knows everyone knows he's not.
Right. Which is a huge gift for him, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That got lost. It's funny.
It did. It got completely lost because the Jews, as well as Christians, have made law out of grace.
So how about that first time when you get God's grace? I just think of Aaron being up there probably weeping.
Yes.
He's so tender. He knows how he's failed.
Yes.
All the people and the Lord. And then he's getting this do-over.
Yeah.
Because of anything he did.
Right.
It's solely because.
Right.
And that's just, I just.
Exactly. Yes.
That time.
Yeah.
Melchizedek.
Okay. And he like almost had the same grace as Jesus as far as being a high priest to live forever.
Yeah.
Was he after Aaron, before Aaron?
He was way before Aaron, okay. And we will talk about Melchizedek. We'll have many studies of Melchizedek, so we'll go into that later. So we have this high priest who's been exposed, and now Moses redresses him in these beautiful priestly white holy garb. And now the priest is able to receive the worshipers. And what he does with each worshiper is he receives them, and the first thing the worshiper does is to confess his sins. And he says right out there, and think about this, this is not done in secret. So Aaron has been exposed and publicly vulnerable, and now each of the worshipers does the same thing. They don't get undressed, but instead they undress who they really are by saying, here's my sin. I've brought an animal, and I'm going to put all my sins here, and I'm going to say the sins. So it wasn't, I come and say, oh, I've sinned. It's, I screamed at somebody this week. I was angry in my heart. I did this. And he puts them on the animal. So the priest receives the worshiper's confessions, which are public. He then receives the worshiper's animals as substitutes for them. The animal is a substitute. Here, this is all of my ugliness right here. And the worshiper says to the priest, this is my ugliness. Would you put it to death? It's not giving me life. So the worshiper brings that, and the priest receives all the ugliness, all the darkness, all the sin of the worshiper. And he receives it, and then he helps the worshiper kill it, gut it, and bloodlet it. Now, do you think this was an easy process? Do you think it was a neat process? What's the process look like?
Bloody,
messy, stinky. Every sense is involved in here. And it's not fun.
I won't say like the sacrament of reconciliation stuff. Like we kind of don't have that, you know, apart from that, a ritual. I don't know.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I feel like my sin doesn't feel as serious because I don't do that.
Right, exactly. I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree. And I do think that there is something to be said about this, wow, I just... I'm hearing them, and that's why the question at the beginning, how good is it for someone to walk into your mess? It's actually kind of good for both. Because you know what? Now I don't have to hide the fact that, my husband and I actually argue. I didn't want anyone to know that.
You know, to one point, though, when they were talking about the Day of Atonement, that then you bring all the heaviness of all your sin back, and they were saying with Jesus, don't be dwelling in that place. Go forward. It's forgotten.
Right.
And don't go. I mean, so that was so refreshing versus old covenant.
Right. Mm. So we'll look at that because that's part of this. So we have the worshipers bringing, here's all my ugliness. Put it to death. It's not giving me life. Let's kill it. Let's gut it. And then the priest brings the blood of the, and the blood is always the representation of life. I'm bringing you, I'm bringing your body of death to God for you. I'm bringing it to you. So I am bringing you to God. And God, in God's presence, will restore life to you again. And he will bring you life. Not because you deserved it, because you, what did you give him? There was no transaction here. You just said, this doesn't give me life. I'm just showing you, I'm vulnerable, I'm exposed here. It's not giving me life. And he said, ah, now I can give you grace. And he gives you new life. So that's just like just a small portion of what it looks like for the Hebrews when they hear high priest. They know that this is what went on. So for us to know that is really good because it really gives us a better picture then of the fact that a high priest receives man's ugliness. He helps him kill it and gut it and bloodlet it. And then he brings the dead man to God. And then God says, oh, you saw that it didn't bring you life. Now I can give you life. So.
It reminds me of a Chilwin Sedlet at the luncheon, the wrecking ball. It's the thing that hits you in your life that exposes what's been there all the time.
Exactly.
And it's really good.
So and it is really good.
I think that we don't have, I feel the same way, we don't have that ritual, but we don't have the Moses that redresses you. Like sometimes you have the, you're undressed and vulnerable, but there's no one there to redress you.
Okay, that's going to be part of Hebrews, is that redressing as well. What I want to do then is I want to look at how Jesus in his life was a high priest. Because we pretty much understand that his death and resurrection was that high priestly role. But he performed his roles as a high priest even in his life. Because the role of a high priest is to bring man to God. But not live man who says, I got it under control. He's supposed to bring dead man to Christ, right? So how did Jesus do that? So I just read through the Gospels and I just picked them out. And there's many, many, many more, but these were good representatives of them, of just places of people that he brought to God as a high priest, and he brought their deadness, their ugliness, their darkness. So in Matthew 8, we have the unclean leper. And the unclean leper comes. Now think about it. A leper is unclean. He's not supposed to be around people. What does he do? Think about everywhere Jesus went, there was a crowd, right? He goes into a crowd with his uncleanness, which means he had to say, unclean, unclean. And he goes vulnerably and saying, Jesus, I am unclean, but you can clean me. It's that worshiper coming to the high priest saying, it's ugly, it's dead, I'm bringing it to you, kill it for me so that I can have life. I'm exposing. So we have the leper do that. We have the despised Roman centurion do that. Remember, the Roman centurion is the figurehead of the Roman government that's oppressing them. And he comes, and of course he's a man of great power. He can command anything. And he says, Jesus, I'm a man of great power, but I have a servant that I love, and I can't do anything for him. But I know you can. And he said, all of these are said within a crowd, which is really interesting, the way that Jesus heals. And the centurion comes and says, I am a man of great power, and I can do nothing for this servant. But I know you can just by your word heal my servant. You don't even need to come because I understand power. I don't have it, but you do. So he comes, vulnerable, exposed. The power I have is nothing. We have the... There's several demon possessed. We have this. Some of the demon possessed, just so you understand, some of the demon possessed are truly a spiritual demon possession, and some are an illness in the mind demon possession. So there's two different kinds in there. I'll just bring out this one, but just remember that there's two. These two demon possessed men are feared and they're violent, so violent that no one would ever go near them. And they come out and they say, you're the Son of God. they recognize right away, you're the Son of God. You have control over me. And then they ask, are you going to send me, or are you going to judge me now before the time of judgment? Are you going to give me no time? It was this, I am, even the demons, I'm a demon and you're God. I recognize that. And I don't have any power to stay here. You can take me out. We go to Matthew 9 and we have the unclean bleeding woman. She's been bleeding for how many years?
18
years, something like that. And she is in a crowd. Guys, this is the same as a leper. A woman who's been bleeding. How many of you read The Red Tent? I mean, in that culture, if you are bleeding, you don't get to go into society. You have to stay apart. Here's this woman bleeding for 18 years. And she comes in the crowd and she hangs on Jesus. And Jesus says, I feel. Remember, this is where we talked about the talith and the wings of healing. I feel my healing power has gone out of me. And it says, I think in the Luke passage where it mentions this, that she told him the whole truth. I am bleeding. Think about this. I mean, even us today, in our normal menstrual cycle, I mean, how many times do you go into a crowd and say, I'm thinking about you in Italy. I'm bleeding. I'm bleeding. You know, I mean, do you say that? It's just not a thing we even do, even in a society where we understand that and we're pretty open about it. We still don't. And yet this woman, where it was considered, ooh, you don't come in society. I'm unclean. But Jesus can heal me, into that crowd. We go to the blind men who are pitied. And they scream and cry out, Lord, have mercy on me. Your mercy is what will bring me healing. Your mercy is what will bring me wholeness. And they scream it and cry out, and people just look at them. How do you look at the people that are on the streets homeless? With pity, right? I mean, pretty much.
Well, so I'm thinking that the people who went to Jesus, though, did exchange the old priestly line of Aaron for the priestly line of Jesus Christ by going to Jesus.
Yes, yes.
Do you know what I mean? Because they were claiming, I can get clean
right.
a different way.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Which is the portion of this, the underlying story of this is they went against what their religious society said. And they said, you know what, that doesn't work. That transactional world, it doesn't work. Following rules and laws, it doesn't work. And that they don't do it privately, and they don't go, Jesus, I'm blind, could you heal me? I'm bleeding, could you heal me? They go right out in the middle of the crowd, that has all the Pharisees every time standing there almost like posts. If you follow the rules, you wouldn't be blind. If you follow the rules. Mm-hmm. And they scream, Jesus, only you can make me clean. This is huge. So it's not just on this level of I'm being exposed and I know this is the only way that I can be healed, but I'm also exposing that transactions don't work living that way.
The other thing is that I'm thinking is when I slip into a transactional mindset, I'm a scoffer.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, I am.
That's exactly.
I am
yes.
Those
yeah.
Pharisees.
That's exactly. That's so encouraging to hear that because I do think this is a tough thing because we are so transactional. But for us to understand that when I'm transactional, I'm scoffing at His grace. I'm scoffing at the way.
Thing, you crucify Him over and over again.
Right.
Exactly.
Yes. As if it didn't count. Yep. Yep. So we have the immoral prostitute who wipes her Jesus' feet with her tears and her hair. And I don't know if you realize that the context of that, but she is in a Pharisee's home. She comes into a Pharisee's home like that. I mean, that's just right there. I'm coming right into the church and saying, you know what? Rules don't work. Jesus, grace. is what gives me life.
Well, what's really interesting is that Jesus was in the Pharisee's home.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, it is actually, because I think there's only twice that he actually goes into a Pharisee's home. Yeah. We also have then a reputable synagogue official. This is Jairus. He's a synagogue official. He is one who has a lot of power, and he's in that culture that said rules work. And he steps out and says, no, wait a second, you know what? These rules aren't working because I have a child that is dying, and the rules haven't worked for that. And I'm willing to say, I'll expose myself and say grace is the only way that's going to bring me any life.
Well, I feel like it's not even them in their strength saying that they're going to speak out against, but it's their circumstances that push them to be exposed.
Exactly.
So it's not even like them in their strength, but rather
being exposed. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that they make this choice. But it is something, a gift that God gave them to expose their need that doesn't get met in a transaction. So, good point. Then we have the everyday father who is shouting and begging for Jesus. My son has seizures, which was, again, another thing. Oh, if seizures, then you did something wrong. So we have all of these. Oh, and I love John 4, because then we have the Samaritan, which we always think about the Samaritan as, well, the Samaritans, you know, they didn't, the Jews didn't like them. Do you understand that the Samaritans were the wrong religion? Do you understand that? Like, there's somebody who believes there's one God, but they don't do it the same way we do it. They don't say the same words. A Samaritan was someone of the wrong religion. And Jesus goes to her. And doesn't even point out, you're the wrong religion. He does say, you worship here, but there will be a time that you'll all worship the same. It's a really interesting thing. There's so much there.
You changed that word for sure. Yeah. When you think about, you know, I mean, we had battles with the Samaritans. And weren't we supposed to clean them out and we left a few, isn't it one of the Samuel things? But
well, yeah, they mixed with the Assyrians, and that's why they're half-breeds.
And then we call good Samaritans, we think of, like, you know, good vigilante kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. There's lots there. But the fact is that Jesus calls her out on her immorality. And she says, isn't this the Christ? I mean, she comes to this realization. This is grace. This is where life is. When not a single Jew would have ever gone to her and said, hey, you know where life is? So we have all of this. And what we have are these places of exposure, these gifts that seem like, how could this be a gift to have leprosy? How could this be a gift to be demon-possessed? How could this be a gift to be blind? And then some of these gifts were ones they chose, to be a prostitute. So we have a mixture of things here. I think we need to understand that all of these things are things that need to be exposed that don't bring life. But not that I can do something about them, but that I can give them to Jesus. He says in Matthew, after all of these, actually it's in the same passages, Matthew 8 and 9, where he talks about all of these times, it's not to the healthy that a physician comes. I didn't come for those who are righteous, but I came for those who are needy, who need grace. Because those who are righteous don't need grace. And that's all I have to give. Jesus says, I only have grace to give. Yeah. So you don't need it? Well, then I didn't come to you. Or you didn't receive me. That's where I came. What all of these are representatives of all of the places that we hide, that we have darknesses. They're not just physical things. But they're spiritual things and emotional things. They are sin, but they're also hiding some of the ugliness of our own lives. There are ways that we are unclean. There are ways that we are despised, that we have this reputation. There are ways that we are feared and violent, that we sell ourselves in some ways. That we rely on power to bring us life. Mm-hmm. That we have embarrassing family situations, like the man with the son with the seizures. We have all of these. And they are places that God gives us as gifts so that we're exposed with the need of needing grace. So I've told this story before about we've had chipmunks, right? Everybody knows we've had chipmunks in the house? Yes? No? Okay. I don't want to tell the whole story because it's a long story and it's a funny story. But for a couple months, every once in a while, we'll have a chipmunk in the house. And I've had to chase them around and I don't like rodents. I think we had two. And after a long story, I finally got rid of them and we're good. And then one day, Carol came to borrow some chairs and we walked down the stairs and we both stopped like, there's a chipmunk just standing there looking at us. Oh, wait a second. If we have three chipmunks, there's a problem. So I know there's a problem. That's a symptom of the problem, right? That there's chipmunks. So I tell Bill, you know, there's somewhere they're getting in. Find the hole. Okay, you know. So knowing that, the whole time I'm waiting for him to find the hole, I'm thinking, you know, as soon as he finds that hole, he just needs to plug it up so we do not have ground squirrels anymore. So just plug it up and repair it, and that'll be good. And he finds it, and there's a little piece that's, you know, it's just a small little hole, but it's in the foundation that holds up the whole house. So I'm thinking, just, you know, board it up, do it, whatever. But of course he says, yeah, that's not going to do it. What I actually need to do is I need to take out the porch in the front. Everybody saw the porch that we don't have any longer. Mm-hmm. Take out the porch so that it's completely exposed to the light, so that I see what the problem is and not just patch up the problem, not just repair it. And when he took out the porch, and so we knew, yeah, there's probably a little rot. Oh my goodness. When that porch came out,
there's a whole family living in there.
The extent of the rot of this is the board in the front of the house that holds up the house.
Right.
The extent of the rot. And I wish, unfortunately, somebody threw it away. Actually, if we go in the dumpster across the street, it's in there. But this is the only piece that I found laying downstairs in the basement. I mean, literally, there was just. So from the inside, we can see that there's a little hole, but when the outside, we even brought a flashlight up there and said, oh yeah, there's a little hole there. But from the outside, when all the deconstruction happened and we took away the solid foundations that we had and everything was exposed, I walked inside, lights everywhere coming inside. A lot of rot. Oh, it was more than floor joists. It was the header and the sill.
Okay, but you know,
yeah, this is huge.
Like, you know, we do this with ourselves. The people who put it in said, we're just going to go over the stump that's there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's cosmetic.
Right.
And it's going to look beautiful.
And it'll take away some of the symptoms, right?
Yeah.
The ground squirrels won't come in anymore.
You never know all the rotting.
Right. And here, it's exposed to light, and now it's, wow, we can't just patch this up.
Mm.
It has to be completely replaced. So we have to take it out before we can replace it with completely brand new header and sill. I mean, just, it was amazing, of course, that would happen this week, because this is exactly what Jesus is doing. Is it has to be exposed to light so you see the extent of the rot and how you think it's going to give you life if I patch it up so I don't have any ground squirrels. And literally, I would sit here every day because he never did patch it. So the hole stayed for the last couple months. And every time the door to the basement would be open, I'd go, that got to close. I don't know how many ground squirrels are going to come in. I mean, we found dead ground squirrels. That's a long story. yeah. Right, exactly. As if the door helped.
Pointing to the crack under the door.
Well, here's, there's so many stories to this. Yes, the ground squirrels actually tried to nibble out. They can't, they're too big. They can't fit under the ground squirrel. But there is lots of wood shavings there because they've tried to get out.
So
it's
so,
kind of like what happens when our foundations are based on lies. And
yep.
if you don't get to the root or the lie,
right.
then what you do in the course of your lifetime is
patch things over. Yep.
You know,
yep.
rather than, and God's saying, no, I want to get to the lie so I can bring truth so that light, real life
right.
can happen.
Right. Exactly. So, this is what Jesus is doing as his high priest role. Is he brings what has been exposed, and the worshiper says, yeah, kill it. Let's kill it together because it's not bringing me life. Because I could have said, oh, I'll get life. Just patch it up. I'll get life. I won't have ground squirrels anymore. But what happens down the road? Yeah, the house falls down.
The wrecking ball comes.
Yeah, the wrecking ball comes, and the deconstruction becomes... So here we have deconstruction, and the deconstruction is going to cost me a lot, because not only in money, but I'm actually going to lose my peony bushes and my... Yeah, I'm going to lose a lot. That's what we have to do. Today, we have to start digging them out.
Of course, Jill, I said, Bill, and I'm thinking, oh, no. Because we've got a whole like highway underneath our
program
students.
Yeah. 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 But I'm so glad that he took that porch out, because I just wanted him to seal it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so glad. I mean, we saw. Wow. So it all was replaced, completely replaced. Everything's new. And now, of course, we have to dig up more stuff. But this is a good thing. Exposure is a good thing. It was a gift to have those ground squirrels in here.
And it's going to take time, too. So when
yep.
we get those things in. I mean, I personally, when those things get exposed, oh, let's just real quick.
Right,
oh,
right,
let,
right, exactly,
yeah, that's fine.
Exactly.
Done,
yeah.
But it
no.
takes time to go in.
Right.
And it takes time for
right.
our minds mentally to understand, oh, I didn't understand.
Right.
I was acting.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yep. So keep that in mind, that picture in mind, when I ask you now, so what are some of the dark things that are in your life that you're trying to patch over, that... you're trying to say to the world, I'm all put together in this. I'm good. I don't ever lose my temper. I don't think in my head, you know, judgmental thoughts. I don't, you know, what of those things? And you know, we can go to all the scriptures where it talks about, you know, pride and envy and jealousy. Those are all issues of the heart, which is what Jesus is using all of these people, these pictures of. All this uncleanliness in us. I want to ask you, what is your darkness that needs to be exposed? So I want you to think about that. And yeah, this is really ugly and tough because, and I'm asking you the stuff that you really don't want people to see. The stuff that you are afraid people might find out is true about you. And I want you to think about that, and then I'm going to pass around all these colored papers, and I want you to rip out the letter, just the first letter of it. I'm not asking you to expose it here. I'm just saying the first letter of it, and just rip out an approximation of that letter for yourself. What I mean...
tear the paper to the letter?
Yeah, yeah. You know, like Hester Prynne. What letter would you be wearing if you were in Puritan times and your name was Hester?
So we have only one that we can do.
Yeah.
I think you have the same letter.
How many letters can I get out of that?
So as you're doing that, I want you to think about how are the ways that I build life? What are the things? I mean, this is almost the same idea as when we made our boxes. What kind of walls am I putting up that I'm getting life? They may be direct sins, or they may be hiding things that are shameful. Those are both transactions. When I hide things that might be shameful, I am saying I will get life. I will be accepted if no one knows about this. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
That's a transaction just as much as me doing something outright. So when I hide things, I'm doing it so that I'm accepted.
So.
Wow. Scary. I can go right to you.
As I think most of you know some of my story, I grew up in a home of a mother who was 15 when she ran away to get married, 16 when she had me, 17 divorced. She moved back to my grandmother's house, and so I lived in a neighborhood, and I was we were the family that was known as, whoa, that's, you know, them. That's, you know, the 15-year-old that ran away and got married, the 16-year-old that had a baby, and now has another one out of wedlock and has to change the divorce decree. And this is who I grew up as. And then now I don't have a father. And I'm living with, not only am I living with my grandparents, but it's the grandmother that works. And the grandfather's blind and depressed. So this was my wow. So from that, I wanted, when I grew up, I wanted to be in a place that I was respectable. I wanted to live in a family that was respectable. I wanted to live where there was no shame at all about my family. And man, believe me, I have tried really hard to hide all of that. Now, I don't ever say that that didn't happen, but hiding it is how I lived, in that I strove to make sure that my life looked shiny, that my family looked shiny, that I was building up a place where I would be accepted. So not only that, but of course, when I was little, my parents sent me to church, but they would not accept my mother because 50 years ago, a divorced woman was not accepted. And we were going to a Baptist church, and they said no. So in church, not only in my neighborhood was I the one who was, ooh, had that shameful family, but in church, I was the only one. My sister and I were the only ones who went to church, and we went to Pioneer Girls, and we went to choir, and we did all these things, and it was always, oh, yeah, you're the parents, you have parents that don't belong to the church. You have this. So for me, to be respectable meant I would grow up and have a family that was, you know, perfect. My children would be missionaries. Literally, this is what I had in my head. You know, everything would just look good, and then in the church, I would be respectable. So for those of you who know my story, you're going, wow, that's exactly what happened, isn't it? I had a really shiny family, and I had a really I was respectable in the church. I was on pastoral staff. And what did God do? He exposed it, right? He completely exposed that's a lie. Because you think you're accepted because you're good, and it's a lie. It's grace that gives you life. So your letters, I was going to have tape to have you wear them.
Put them on with our name
tag. Yeah, there you go. You can clip on with your name tag. Jesus, as high priest, is asking you, would you bring that stuff to me and be exposed? Would you say, this isn't giving me life? Would you be willing to let those times of exposure have Jesus bring you grace and say, this no longer has power over you. You no longer have to hide and pretend that things aren't all put together, that you're not all put together. Jesus already knows you're not all put together, but we think, oh, now I've done pretty well. And I will tell you this in all honesty. In my darkest night, I screamed out to him, God, I have done everything you've wanted me to do. And now this, you're ruining my reputation? I said that to him. And he said right back to me, yeah, I know how that feels. I know what that feels like. I know. And I never promised you a reputation based on your good works. I mean, it was just kind of comical, but it is where we are. So each of these people, each of you, Jesus says, bring me your ugliness. I want to take it. I'm your high priest. I'm the one who gets to take that ugliness if you want to give it to me. What these people did not do was say, oh, I know this is bad in me, so I'm going to give you my willingness to work on it. Yeah, this is bad. So Jesus, here, I'm going to give you my hard work. I am going to really try hard not to be this. Or not to do this. None of these people did this. They all said, here I am. I can't do anything about it. could you take it and kill it and give me new life? Do you see the difference between the two? Because we say, oh, this is not good in me, this is ugly in me, this is darkness, so I need to work on it. That's what God wants me to do. That is scoffing. That is opposing grace. That is disobedience. I'm supposed to work on it.
Well, we're almost encouraged to yell, to get to a place where we could yell out, clean.
Yes, exactly. Yes, exactly.
Yelling out.
Right, right, exactly. Exactly. They said, I'm not giving you a willingness to work on this. I'm just saying, here it is. It's ugly and it doesn't give me life, and I'm going to give it to you so you can help me kill it and so that you can restore life to me. Because all my work on it will be nothing. It will never bring me life. But Jesus taking that ugliness, letting that grace come, yep, it's exposed, and we'll talk about why that's grace. But I'm going to expose it to you so that you can receive my grace. I'm going to expose and say, yeah, you have a need here. Your whole sill is rotted out, and you need to have it replaced, not patched up. You need it completely replaced. And it's grace to have had the ground swirls. It's grace then to have had to deconstruct my front porch. It's grace actually to have to move and perhaps lose my oldest peonies. For me, that's a big deal. But it's grace because I have something new for you, something much better for you. The last story that I want us to look at from Jesus being a high priest in his life is to the adulterous woman caught in the act. This story is one of those stories that we gravitate to and yet don't know the depth of it. We did study it in Leviticus, so for some of you, you'll understand this. But maybe now you'll see in this new light of what's happening. So the context, let's first of all read John 8, 3 through 13. Somebody read that for me.
And the scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery, and having set her in the midst, they said to him, Teacher, this woman has been caught in adultery in the very act. Now, in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What then do you say? And they were saying this, testing him, in order that they might have grounds for accusing him. But Jesus stooped down and with his finger wrote on the ground. But when they persisted in asking him, he straightened up and said to them, He who is without sin among you, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. And when they heard it, they began to go out one by one, beginning with the older ones. And he was left alone, and the woman where she had been in the midst. And straightening up, Jesus said to her, Woman, where are they? Did no one condemn you? And she said, No one, Lord. And Jesus said, Neither do I condemn you. Go your way. From now on, sin no more. Again, therefore, Jesus spoke to them, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in the darkness, but shall have the light of life. How far did you
Right there.
Okay.
So, we always leave off that last line, because Jesus ends by turning back to the disciples and saying, Understand, what I'm trying to teach you here is I'm the light. I'm the one who will expose. But let's put this in context. So it happens to be the day after the Feast of Tabernacles. So what you need to know is what happens during the Feast of Tabernacles. What have they all just experienced and just heard? The Feast of Tabernacles is actually the feast that celebrates the full harvest has now come in. And it's the big celebration. Everything has been completed. The full harvest has come in and we are celebrating. It is a picture of what the restored Eden will look like. So this is what we study in Leviticus, part of this. In that celebration, they read, so for each celebration, there's a certain passage that they read out of what we call the Old Testament that they read. So this is what would have been read. During that time, this is also the time when Jesus declares, I am the living water. So he declares it during this time when they are celebrating the Feast of Tabernacles. And during the feast, this is what gets read. It is Jeremiah 17, and we'll read 5 through 14. So somebody read to me, but you have to have an NIV or NAS, because they lose some of that. Keep your mind on what's happened in this story, and then let's read Jeremiah. Does somebody have that?
Jeremiah 5
through, what do I have?
Jeremiah 17,
5 through 14. Somebody want to read it?
This is what the Lord says. First is the one who trusts in man, who depends on flesh for his strength, and whose heart turns away from the Lord. He will be like a bush in the wastelands. He will not see prosperity when it comes. He will dwell in the parched places of the desert, in salt land where no one lives. But blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose confidence is in him. He will be like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream. It does not fear when heat comes. Its leaves are always green. It has no worries in a year of drought and never fails to bear fruit. The heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? I, the Lord, search the heart and examine the mind to reward a man according to his conduct, according to what his deeds deserve. Through 15?
Yeah.
Like a partridge that hatches eggs it did not lay, is the man who gains riches by unjust means. When his life is half gone, they will desert him, and in the end he will prove to be a fool. A glorious throne, exalted from the beginning, is the place of our sanctuary. O Lord, the hope of Israel, all who forsake you will be put to shame. Those who turn away from you will be written in the dust, because they have forsaken the Lord, the spring of living water. Heal me, O Lord, and I will be healed. Save me, and I will be saved, for you are the one I praise.
Okay. All right, now go back to what we're doing. They've just heard this. And Jesus now has in front of him an adulterous woman. And the Pharisees and all the good people are saying, we need to stone her. And he goes down into the dust and writes something. What does he write?
We don't know.
Yeah, we do.
Mm-hmm.
He's writing what Jeremiah 17 is saying. He's writing their names down. And he's writing their names down because what he has done is this woman has been exposed as someone who needs grace. And these people are all saying, yeah, she doesn't follow the law. And we're good and we follow the law. And Jesus is giving them time. So he's writing it. And notice he's writing in the sand, something easily erased. And he's writing in the sand, as it says in Jeremiah 17, all those who forsake coming to the throne of grace. I'm writing those who say, I don't need the throne of grace. I don't need that place of sanctuary because my works are good. And as he's writing them, he's giving them time. They see what he's writing. And he's basically saying, will you stand with her? Will you be exposed? I'm giving you a chance. This is grace here. I'm giving you an opportunity to say, you know what? I've got darkness in me too. How about you and I, prostitute or adulterer? How about you and I say we both need grace? And he gives the opportunity to all of them standing there. And what do? They all walk away. They all walk away. And so Jesus, of course, acts this out. He lets the woman's, and the woman, she didn't choose to be exposed, but she was caught. And what does she do? She doesn't run away. And she doesn't say, well, yeah, what about the guy? She doesn't rationalize, but I needed love. She doesn't say anything. She just receives the exposure in front of everybody. But she also notices that Jesus, this high priest, has come to her without condemnation. And he says, I don't condemn you. I'm giving you grace. I'm giving you what you don't deserve. I'm giving you my presence here. I'm not separating myself. I'm staying right here. But then I'm also giving you grace in this opportunity, because he doesn't leave it there, does he? He doesn't say, I don't condemn you. What does he say? Now go and sin no more. Now take the opportunity to continue to live in grace. To continue to live, not by law, but by grace. Because he just condemned living by law by writing down all of those names that stood around in the sand. And the neat thing is that he wrote it in the sand, that they have the opportunity to have that erased. That they have the opportunity to say, wow, law doesn't get me life. And instead they turn and walk away. So you understand now the context of that. They understood what Jesus was doing because of what they knew. They celebrated every year of what the kingdom would look like, a place where you go to the throne of grace, where that's your sanctuary and your hope of healing, which is interesting because it's how we started Hebrews in the very beginning. If you go back to your page one, we said, where's my page one? We said that in Hebrews talks about this, that Jesus is opening the throne of grace. That's what we find out in 4. We find out in 9 that he dwells in the real sanctuary. And we find out in 6 and 7 that he is the hope of full healing, which is exactly what Jeremiah says. This Jesus, this grace that he gives, is what eternity is. It's grace. It's grace, it's grace, it's grace. And there's opportunity not just to receive it and to receive this, wow, you're accepting me just as I am. And then you're giving me more grace to say, you don't have to live like this. Because I've made you for better and greater things. Living a life of receiving the gift of life rather than trying to get it for myself. And then at the end of all of that, Jesus turns to the disciples and he said, here's the lesson. I am the light of the world. Those who walk in the light will have no darkness. Mm-hmm. My light is there. And I think it's kind of interesting because when we consider Jesus as the light, this is what I think we think, that he's the light who's going to show us the way to go. Mm-hmm. But the point is, Jesus is the light who shows me who I am, how much I need him, where I need to have complete restoration of his life in me. So those replacement parts are his parts that I get replaced, not patched up. The law patches up. Grace restores and replaces. So thinking about Jesus as a light. So when we read that, and we always take that out of context, don't we? We always take that verse and we say, Jesus is the light of the world. Those who walk in light will not have darkness. And we never think about it. The fact is, Jesus is the light that shines on me to expose all the things I'm trying to say I'm good enough to be accepted. And that's a gift for him to shine his light on me and expose me. And then I won't have to walk in darkness. Because here's the thing. It frees us. And Sherilyn said at the very beginning, it's so free, so freeing when I'm exposed. Wow, now everybody knows I don't have a perfect family. I have not controlled my situation well enough. It doesn't work. Everybody knows this. Everybody knows that I like to control. Everybody knows this. And now it's like, wow, I don't have to. I don't have to hide it anymore. I don't have to pretend that I have a shiny life. I don't have to pretend that I teach this, so I do all of this. I don't have to pretend that. And that's so freeing. Mm-hmm. It's so freeing not to have to walk around. What if somebody walks in and Bill and I are having an argument? And do I sometimes still want to pretend that? Yep. But then he brings me these situations of light, and he says, here's grace. Do you want it? Does this make sense? Yes?
Well, in darkness, I think when we read that, we think of sin, mm-hmm. but rather darkness is really secrecy.
Right. Because, yes, well, of course we have sin. We know that. But our remedy to it is to patch it up, and I'll do good. And Jesus said, yeah. You're just getting rid of some of the symptoms, but they'll eventually come back. Let's think about this. If I just patched up so that no ground squirrels came in, and let's say we lived here 25 more years. In 25 years, do you think the ground squirrels would be back? Well, of course, if it's rotting and I'm just patching up the little hole, it's all rotted from the outside, they'll probably be back in less than a couple months. And I'll be overwhelmed with them.
right? Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly.
But you know, I think like even in your story about like you growing up and all that, like I think part of the confusion lies on what we think the gospel produces.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? Like we've kind of been sold that the gospel produced a really like great life.
Right.
I mean that's what you
right.
do you know what
right.
I mean? You
yep.
It's like
yep.
well our children will obey and they will walk in this path and we will
yep.
you know, shine like
yep.
stars in the universe.
Right,
and,
right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
I don't
or
know.
Even that that's enjoyable or joy. Like even
right.
that we
right.
think
right.
that that is
because what we've done then is again turned it into a transaction.
Right.
So it's not about that. The gift is that I get to live in grace. And this is not something we all want, to live in grace. Because it means always being exposed, always receiving gifts. Always receiving gifts. Let me ask you this. So when you are at the grocery store in a checkout line, and you want to go in the 10 items or less, and you can't go behind someone and they have 40 items. How do you feel?
It's unjust.
Unjust. Not right. Think about it. I almost showed you another Parenthood clip and I thought they're going to think this is all I do is watch Parenthood. But there's a great clip about them being in the grocery store.
It's kind of this all we do.
My light exposed. Yeah. We have the tapes so
we
watch
working,
them.
Right?
Yes.
Getting them through the season.
All right, so you feel that. So a lot of us, not all of us, but a lot of us feel, oh, they shouldn't be there. Why are they doing that? I'm in a hurry, and I have 10 items, and I should be here, and you shouldn't, right?
And I'm following the rules.
And I'm following the rules,
right,
and
exactly.
they're not following the rules.
Yeah.
I mean, there's this distinction. Now turn it around. You're in a regular lane. You have a whole cart. Nobody's in the 10-item lane, and the cashier says, hey, come on over here. And you're there, and you're putting them out, and then somebody walks behind you, and they have two items. Now, how do you feel? What's the first thing you want to do? Ah, see? Exactly. You want to turn around and say, really, really? I deserve this because she told me. What we want to do is say, I'm still following rules. I still deserve this because I followed the cashier. Rather than say, wasn't this great? I can't believe that I get to do this. But see?
Grocery store thing a lot another thing that, like, and this is like, I could pray about it because I just think about living. I think, honestly, almost everything I do is transactional. And, like, I might give someone a grace. A lot of times it was in the grocery store. You go ahead. There are days when I don't. And, like, that's the only example that I can think where I'm not transactional. I'm thinking, is every single thing I do with my children. And I feel like that is just so sad. That's the only example I can think of that's not transactional. And that's because I'm in the mood. I mean, this is like scary and sad because you can't just say, could you forgive me for this one? This is how I'm living.
Right. But here's the cool thing is, Jill, and you've known this, as we put out, wow, God, I am transactional in almost every area of my life. And this has given me life. Would you take it and would you start to deconstruct it? Because I can't. And if I try, what happens is I become transactional with it. Which is, I mean, it's almost funny in a way, but that's where we all are. But it's the grace that we're to live in. And this is the invitation of the high priest. Come, I'll take that. I'll take it. I'll help you kill it. I'll bring it and I'll bring you some life. But it's going to take some deconstruction. And then to rest in his deconstruction, to rest in that time. I think the grocery store thing is a really good example because although you may not be one who is irritated that people have 40 things, I can bet you to a person that we, if we're called into that line and we've been given grace, we go, oh no, I don't want you to think that I'm not following the rules, right? That's pretty much how we feel. That is, I don't want to receive grace. I want to make sure that everything I get, I deserve. That's the transaction.
So let's think about that, and then realize that worship not only needs a high priest, but worship needs grace. Worship can't happen without grace, because we've already made that decision that we know how to get life. And once we've made that decision, then I don't have this connection to the one I want to worship, the one who is life, who gives me life. So our high priest offers then to retell our story. And we've talked about this before, as amazing grace. Here's the high priest standing there. I'd love to take your story and make it a grace story. Do you mind? Would you like to? I'm shining my light to show you, here's an opportunity, here's an invitation, here's a call. I want to give you grace. Grace, I want to give you at this point of exposure. Can I tell it as amazing grace? Or do you not want it retold? Do you still want it told as a transaction? As I can do this and I get this. How do you want it told? You want to tell it, or do you want God to tell it?
I also love that, like, even if you don't listen to that moment of it, grace being offered, that God extends grace and gives you other opportunities.
Yep.
Like,
yep, exactly.
It's a continual.
Which is why, what does Hebrews say over again? Today. Today, if you hear his voice. And then he renews it. Today. You didn't hear it yesterday, but today. Today, if you hear his voice. And I'll renew it again tomorrow. Today. Today, if you hear his voice. Come. So our high priest says, let me retell your story as grace. This is how I'm going to do it. I will shed light on your darkness. I will come and bring some deconstruction into your life so that you begin to see. I'm going to take out the stoop and you see how much rot is there. That's a gift. I'm going to start little. I'm going to give you a ground squirrel. That's a gift. So when you're running around, think, and this is the whole practice that we've been doing. Remember that everything is a gift? If I was practicing that, when that ground squirrel is running around my dining room and I'm chasing him, I'm thinking, wow, this is a gift. This is a gift. This is a gift. This is a gift. And he runs up my stairs, upstairs. This is a gift. This is a gift. But we know the whole story, and we know it is. Because had that ground squirrel not been that, and that was traumatic to me, and then it was traumatic to find the dead ones down there, and all of that. Without all of that, we wouldn't have gotten to that point. Because the rotting, we can't see. We had to move all the ceiling to look for, we had to look for it. But just that little thing was a gift.
We had a good friend of Paul's, and he was in his mid-40s and had 5 children, and he was diagnosed with a serious illness and ended up passing away. And during that illness time frame, one of the things he said to Paul was, this is not how I wanted the chapters of my life to be written. But he kept telling Paul, I know it ends well.
Mm-hmm.
I know it ends
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't talking about eternity.
Right.
He was talking about, this is not what I wanted for my life. This isn't what I wanted for my wife or my children. But I'm okay with it.
Yep.
And there really was a celebration of his life when he passed away. Not because he had entered into eternity, in part,
mm-hmm.
but also because he admitted this isn't what I didn't want this.
And that is a lot of that exposure part is being completely honest before Jesus, being completely honest before one another. This is hard stuff. This is not easy.
So we have a pretty serious ground school problem too. And we've done like the whole tried the humane thing and then some inhumane thing, just trying to get rid of those squirrels. And I heard a friend of mine told me that there had been people capturing ground squirrels in other areas of the neighborhood and dropping them off at the library, which is right behind our house. And my instant reaction was, that is so unfair. I am spending so much money on like poison and peanuts and traps and driving, you know, miles away to mainly drop off these ground squirrels. But I think it makes me really angry that they would not think about what they're doing to me. Sometimes I wonder if the things that God exposes in our lives
to me, we feel is so unfair. Why do I have to be the one who's going through this? Why am I the one who's exposed? Why can't you be exposed and not me? I didn't earn this right to be exposed. I would rather not have this. And it is so not, you're right, it is so not a transaction. It's you can't earn the right to be exposed or not to be exposed. Right. It is truly that gift that he's going to give to us.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Yesterday I was journaling and I saw the Lord shaking out a rug like this. And he said, I'm cleaning house in all areas. And you don't know where the dust is until I shake it. And just even having that picture and having this background, this teaching, it's if you know it's for good and if you hold on that it's for good, that the shaking is to expose so that he can clean up, so that he can restore and redeem and make whole again. Mm-hmm. Your house is now whole. You didn't know that.
Right.
But unless there's a shaking, the dirt just stays on the rug.
Right.
So I guess just even having that understanding that it's for good. The shaking's for good. And then on a broader sense, even I said, I'm cleaning house everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm cleaning nations. I'm cleaning the world. I'm shaking everything to expose.
Right.
So it's just given me a little bit more of a rest in that.
Yeah. And that's the point is the first the exposure comes and we want to know, Jesus says, will you accept it? Will you, grace is going to meet you in those moments of exposure. Will you accept that grace? And when you accept that grace, then grace will also give you freedom. Wow, I don't have to hide anymore. I have this, I do not have to pretend that I've got it all together anymore. And really, isn't that when you feel most at home is when you don't have at all pretend in any way. Like, whoever you're with, they know it all. And it hasn't changed. They're still there. That you still accepted. All of a sudden, there's this freedom of, wow, that's nice. That's home. It's exactly it. Grace is home. It is what we have been made for. To be completely exposed gives us that rest. So it and helps us, that's what Jesus says, that he helps us go to that place of, it disarms the power of the darkness. It doesn't have any power anymore, and now you can rest, and I can rest in the grace that I'm accepted for who I am. And I can, we don't have any time, but there's so many. What I hope happens is that you begin to think about all of those verses that you know, my grace is sufficient. Well, it doesn't mean, it's just enough to get you by. It means, no, what my grace is what you need. It's life. My grace is life. It's not just a thing to get you through something. It's what you need. It is life. Grace is life. For us to think that grace is just a thing that I get every once in a while is to miss the point. Grace is life. Jesus is very gentle with those who are humble and say, okay, expose me. I will take that grace there. And he's very gentle and humble with them. But for those who say, nope, don't need grace, I'll follow the law, thank you. He rebukes them. He's angry with them. And what is he? Does anyone know what he calls them? Yeah. What?
Brood of vipers.
Brood of vipers is what? That's what John called them.
Whitewashed tombs.
He calls them sons of hell.
Oh.
You sons of hell.
Wow.
Right out there. I mean, he doesn't mince words. You oppose the grace that I want to give you. You oppose that. That means you've chosen to be a son of hell. So we have him shining his light. We have him offering acceptance for right where you're at, right now, with no condemnation. This continual flow of living waters, as he said, I'm the living waters. I'm going to give you nourishment so I can rest that I'm accepted in full light. In all my rotted stuff, he accepts me right there, which is huge grace. And I can rest in that. I can stop striving to make sure that I'm good enough to be accepted. I can stop. There's that rest. But then he gives, so there's three parts of this grace. The exposure, the rest, but then
the gift of, here, I have grace for you to continue living in this grace. So it's not just for one moment or two moments. It's a place you live in. The fact is, what we are being given is opportunity after opportunity to practice living in grace, because eternity is grace. I think we think about grace as being something that's for here and now, and that we won't need it in eternity. The fact is, that's what eternity is. It's grace. That's what Eden was. It was complete grace. I have all these gifts for you. I have all these provisions. I even have this wonderful work for you that's fun and creative and exciting. All of this is grace. And it's not a place of static perfection. Wholeness means I'm wholly receiving God's gifts. That's wholeness. So it might begin to transform your idea of even what you're looking toward. And most of us look toward this reward, this transaction of everything then will be perfect and not needing growth, right? And he says, grow in grace, because it's what you're going to be living in. It's that opportunity.
I might be connecting two wrong places here, but doesn't Paul say, you know, God gave me this thorn and I prayed three times for him to take it away, but he said, my grace is sufficient?
Yep, that's it.
I mean, it's like sometimes these thorns we have, mm-hmm. and we do say, God, please take this away. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not always just exposing something that we've been keeping secret, but sometimes it's...
Right. Some horrible thing that's outside us. Yes, yes. And when he says, my grace is sufficient, please understand he's not saying, I'll give you this gift so you can get through it. He's saying, my grace is life. I'm giving you this as life. And it doesn't look like it, and it doesn't sound like it, because it's not a transaction. I'm just giving you this as a gift, because this is what you'll be living in. This is what I'm getting you ready for, is to live in grace all the time. So remembering that grace is not just for now, but forever. That tertiary grace is that offering of healing. Go continue to live in grace, because this is where the healing process is. This is where the completion will begin. And it will be a process. It will take time, but it's only available at the throne of grace. It's the only place it is, but it will give you replacement parts. It will give you a completely new header and sill rather than patches. Completely new, and they will be his replacement parts, not mine. Not what I thought up. Because my thought was, spray that insulation there in there. That would be good enough. Just if you want to write these down, just if you're wondering, really, is grace what goes into eternity? Is grace what we'll live in? And I'm not going to go through them, but Romans 5, 20 through 21, Ephesians 2, 8, those are just two places where it talks about the fact that grace is for eternal life. Grace is what we will live in. Oh, Romans 5, 20 through 21, Ephesians 2, 8. So, all of that, succinctly put in Hebrew terms, in Hebrew, the letter of Hebrew terms, our high priest is inviting us, first of all, to consider him and hold fast to him. He is grace. In other words, count him as more valuable than anything that you can put on the table, which is your law, your rules, making sure that you look good so that you're accepted. He, grace, is more valuable than all that. Count that. And own the light, and let the light own you. Let that light stay in you completely, continuing to expose where he wants to expose. Those are all grace. That's grace. Draw near to him, because his grace is rest. Just as I am, I'm unconditionally loved and accepted. Just as I am. But he wants the exposure. And that's what comes and rests under grace. So that I receive his hand that gives me rest. Oh, he accepts me and he gives me this as a grace. His presence is a huge grace there. And thirdly, he invites us to press on. And before I say this, I'm going to say what that is a picture of is the prodigal son. So think about the prodigal son. He first was living a very transactional life, right? Father, give me all my inheritance, and I'm going to go, and I'm going to, for all this money, I'm going to get this kind of a life. And what did he find out? It wasn't life, right? Didn't get life out of it. And he said, I know I can go back to the Father, and I can get life as a servant. That's what he says. And before, of course, he even gets to the Father, what does the Father do? He runs to him, and he grabs him. Remember that breathing exercise? He grabs him, and he's so happy and so glad that he comes to him. And he kills the fatted calf, and he puts a robe on him, and he gives him a ring, and he brings him into this great party. Now, the fact is, that's the third aspect. That party is that third aspect of grace. He gave him grace, exposed. I'm giving you grace by giving you the transactional life you want, and I'm going to show you it doesn't work. And I'm going to receive you back into my presence so you can rest. But I'm going to say, let's continue to live in that grace. I'm going to give you a party. And here's the thing about that party. We don't talk about that a lot. He'd been having parties for a long time, right? Mm-hmm. This prodigal son, he'd partied with prostitutes and high living, everything else. So he had already had the chance to make his own parties, and they didn't work, and they weren't life. He comes home, and he gets this grace upon grace upon grace. And this third grace is this party where who has decided who would come to this party?
The Father.
The Father. Who has chosen what kind of clothes he'll get to wear?
The Father.
The Father. Who's chosen what he gets to eat?
The Father.
The Father. You see, the grace is, I will take what you give me as a real life. This community, what you gave me, is who I'm to give have a life with. This robe, this identity you've given me, is where life is. Not the identity I wanted. Mm-hmm. You see that? You see that picture?
Yeah.
That all that party place? That's all God got to choose. All the Father got to choose. All the pieces of it. He chose the decorations and the music and everything. And the Son is happy to be in there. But then we have the elder son, of course, which we'll talk about in a minute. So to press on means that I live in the party that he's provided, the community that he's chosen, the robe that he's chosen, the identity, the food that he's prepared. All of that replaces what I had chosen, what I thought was a good party, fellows and good decorations and good food and all of that. He's replacing that all. And notice, the son never says, oh, but Dad, I wanted to invite this person. Or, but Dad, can't we have lamb instead of calf? He's just like, give me the grace, give me the grace, give me whatever you want, because I know that's life. I've already seen that my life isn't.
I am so transactional, though. I feel sorry for the brother. That's how transactional I am. I'm sitting here thinking, and the other guy, he had to leave. He left the party because
yep.
He was jealous.
Yep.
He couldn't handle it.
And
we'll,
so often want to put ourselves in his shoes instead of
which is so interesting. And the whole story is, life is grace. You being exposed so that you receive grace. And then we like, oh, I don't want that. We're going to look at that in just a second.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that the prodigal son went through, everything that all of those people who are exposed go through, is a sacrifice of praise and gratitude, which is worship. This is worship. I will give up what I thought was life. I will give up the fact that I can't even make it into life. Like, this is ugly, and I'm going to try to work on it. I'm going to give that up. I'm going to give up my picture, and I'm going to offer all this as, here, kill it. Just kill it, because it's not giving me life. And you do with it what you need to bring and restore me to life. That is that picture of us holding fast to him, letting him shine his light on me, letting him accept me for who I am. And not, we so often want, we think Jesus has to accept me because I did this for you. And we talk about this all the time, you know, working for God, which is always kind of funny. But if worship needs a high priest and worship needs grace, then what does worship look like when there is no high priest and there is no grace? What it looks like is profanity. Mm-hmm. That word profane actually comes out of the Hebrew that means
to live outside the sanctuary, to live outside the throne of grace. So we're trying to worship, trying to say, oh, Jesus, I believe you. You died for my sins. And then to live a life not accepting grace is profanity. That's what profanity really is. That's a profane life. So it's a refusal to be exposed, vulnerable. I'm not sick. I'm not sick. No, I have this cancer growing in, but I'm not sick. I'm not sick. A refusal to live life under grace. I deserve a good life because I've worked hard at it. I've followed all the rules. A refusal to come into his grace-filled party. I'll decide what kind of party I want, who gets to be there, and all of that. Basically, holding fast to a transactional life. Ooh, yes, transactional life. No, no, I'm going to hold fast to that. In fact, this is the most interesting. So I think this is just the real symbol that came this week. They have a whole article in here called The Rule of Reciprocity.
No.
About 40 years ago, a Kentucky-based nonprofit had a bright idea. The charity decided to send potential donors free personalized address labels. After the labels arrived in the mailbox across the nation, contributors to the group nearly doubled, jumping from 18% to 35%. Why was this marketing gimmick so successful and copied by countless others? Because of a phenomenon called the rule of reciprocity. The concept is simple enough. When people are given something for free, they typically feel obliged to make a gesture or even a purchase in return. The principle applies even when the free item is unsolicited and inexpensive. The acts of generosity may seem like good old-fashioned customer service, but they actually prompt you to lay down cash. So we've used this, and nonprofits use it the most, which is a little bit scary. This is how we live. We live transaction. We get a free gift. Ooh, got to give it. The grocery store. Ooh, I got to explain why I'm in this 10-item line when I shouldn't be.
Or even if someone gives you a compliment.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Right. Exactly. So there's this underlying, I can't have this. There's this underlying need for me to earn and deserve it. And that's right. Right, exactly.
In Costco, where I'm giving out these demos, this is so true, you guys, and I'm so nice to everyone. I'm like, and they're like, can I have another one? I'm like, yeah, but if you try it twice, you got to buy it, you know, joking with them and stuff. So many people have gone to buy it just because I was nice to them, and they told me that. Honestly, so it's true.
Yes, it is.
I feel compelled to buy something when I sample something.
Yeah.
That's funny. That's like, really?
I know.
They're giving you free samples.
It's true, though.
So here are the examples that Jesus encounters two people like this. The rich young ruler of Mark 10, where he comes and he says, Jesus, his question is, how do I get eternal life? He wants to live in eternity. But he says, I've done this and this and this and this. What else do I need to do to get it? And Jesus says, nothing, basically, just receive the fact that I'm going to expose you. I'm going to expose the fact that you can't get it. Because his riches is what enabled him actually to follow all those commandments. Wow. Jesus says, I'll expose you and we'll see. And what happens to the rich young ruler? Does the same thing as the Pharisees. He walks away, right? He walks away sad. Ooh, I've been exposed. And now I'm not going to accept that grace. That I'm not going to accept. And then, of course, we have the elder son. And you're right, we do tend to sometimes gravitate toward him because he worked hard. But listen to him. He says, I have worked my butt off. I have done everything. And I've never gotten a party with my friends. What he wants, I want eternal life to look like what I decide. I don't want grace. I don't want you to invite friends and you to invite a fatted calf. I want it to be under my control because I've worked hard for it. So I want eternal life. I want to live in that perfect world, and I want it to have it because I deserve it. I don't want
to tell you that I have a story that needs to be retold. My story is just fine the way it is. And I deserve to get something for such a good story that I've made. That's the story of the elder son and the rich young ruler and countless of the Pharisees. I don't need you to retell my story, Jesus, because I don't need the grace. I deserve eternal life because I followed the rules. So when you look at it, grace is life. It's where we're going to be living. It's what we're giving practice doing, living in grace. And everything we do, everything we think, who we are, will either be an act of transaction, of profanity, or an act of worship, receiving grace. One of the two. Father, we thank you that you over and over and over again call us today. Today I have grace for you. Would you like it? Thank you for being the light that shines on us. Thank you that in shining on us, we receive a gift of your presence, of your acceptance, and of your grace to continue to live in grace. Father, I pray that the idea of living in grace will be solidified in our hearts. It's not an easy thing for us to grasp because we so are sold into this transactional world. Father, we pray that as we receive grace, that we would find the freedom in it, find the freedom in the exposure, that we would find the freedom in the rest, that we would be delighted and rejoicing in the freedom to continue to live in grace. And as we do, we open up grace to all sorts of other people. Father, you are life. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Joe, what were those three things that you said at the end?
Right. Yeah.